This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. This year, Kalamazoo College's annual Thompson Lecture features a screening of the documentary An American Conscience, The Reinhold Niebuhr Story. Coming up, we'll talk with Jeremy Sabella, who was a consultant on the film and wrote a companion book. But first, the YWCA of Kalamazoo is among the organizations throughout the country taking part this week in a stand against racism. Sherry Brockaway is Director of Training and Community Impact, and Demetrius Wolverton is Community Education Specialist for the YWCA of Kalamazoo. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So what will be happening this week in Kalamazoo?
We are very excited to announce that we are having a stand against racism, and we're going to be doing a 24-hour stand to show our commitment to eliminating racism in Kalamazoo. So we're inviting everybody to join us Friday from noon until Saturday at noon, but more specifically at 5 p.m. on Friday, we want to cover a 4-block radius holding hands to show a solid commitment to ending racism, and that's where we'd really like people to be able to join us. We're going to have Dr. Grace Lubama speaking, Gail Griffin, a local author, and Cherie Thomas from the Douglas Association will be speaking from 6 to 6:30. Our speakers.
And Grace Lubama, we should note for people who are not up with this, is the CEO of the YWCA of Kalamazoo.
That is correct.
So will there be people there who plan to take part in all 24 hours?
That is correct.
Yes, we actually have a sign-up sheet at the YWCA. So if community members want to come in our vestibule of the building and sign up, they can do that. Also, we have staff participation. We'll have refreshments at the 5 o'clock ceremony. We're having a taco bar, so come and eat. It's always good to have food while you're doing mission work.
What is the message that you're hoping that you will send over the course of 24 hours and perhaps a little bit more than that?
To show that Kalamazoo has a strong commitment to eliminate racism in our community, and we're willing to take that stand and show our support and do whatever it takes to eliminate racism. We want to keep the conversation going. We know it's alive and well in Kalamazoo, and the more we address it, the more we can work towards eliminating it.
What signs do you see that tells you that the conversation is alive and well in Kalamazoo?
Well, we're seeing a lot more events going on around Kalamazoo, different organizations. We're being asked at the YWCA to do more presentations and speak outs about it. We're getting a lot of calls about the Stand Against Racism, which is one of the first years. We're seeing a lot of excitement in the community.
Demetrius, did you want to say something there?
You know, I don't even think that we even have to dance around the elephant. Like, just look at the climate of the country. Look at the climate of Southwest Michigan and what that's looking like. You have all different type of groups popping up, individuals doing rallies and individuals doing protests, and you have individuals that are coming together and hosting summits and all these different things. And I think it's a really, really great thing. But we have to be united in our stand against racism. And so this is the YWCA putting out a call for everyone who is out there that's doing this mission work, who truly believes that they are anti-racist or on that journey to be an anti-racist, to come and join us in solidarity as a community member, as an organization, as an anti-racist, whatever label that you want to have, to come in solidarity and stand together. Because when we have numbers, that's when we can move the agenda in eliminating racism here in Kalamazoo.
But you mentioned the climate there. Are there also some negative aspects of the climate right now that you think are maybe driving the people to want to take part in something like this?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that in recent years, we've been a little passive on how we dealt with racial bias or racial inequities. And I think that now the climate is pushing people outside of their comfort zone, because now, you know, it's your family, it's your friends, it's your children, it's your siblings, it's people that you work with, it's your loved ones that are under attack. They're being impacted in a way that is very negative. And so now people are like, well, what can I do to stand in solidarity? What can I do to support the people that I love? And I think that this is a perfect opportunity to show your commitment to ending these types of discrimination.
There's certain facets here that stand out. For instance, you know, when we talk about racism, there's many different things. There's people being harassed, or perhaps the victim of a hate crime, which we've talked about before, and we'll talk about a little bit later. But also then there's employment discrimination, housing discrimination. Is this one big umbrella that all of this falls under? Or are there certain things that stand out right now to you that need to be addressed quicker, perhaps?
Discrimination is discrimination. Racism is racism. It doesn't matter if you're being discriminated against on your job. It doesn't mean if you're getting discriminated against on your landlord. It doesn't mean if you're getting discriminated against when you're walking into the grocery store. Discrimination is discrimination. And I think that what the stand is saying is we are trying to end racism in all facets. We want to be able to create an inclusive community here in Kalamazoo. And Kalamazoo is a very progressive community, don't get me wrong. And I think that we as a community take on a lot of different initiatives to support individuals in these marginalized communities. And I think that this is just the time where we're going to the next level.
What does Kalamazoo need to do to get to the next level?
So they need to join us April 28th at 12 p.m. for our Stand Against Racism, 353 East Michigan Avenue.
But I guess my question more is, what are the steps Kalamazoo needs to take? You said it's a progressive community mm-hmm. and an inclusive community, but if it's going to eliminate racism, mm-hmm. what would have to happen?
I just think that we just need to be more intentional on how we are doing things in the community and to abandon some of the passive ways we address racial inequities and racial bias. And I think that that's what's happening now. Actually, I think that that is why we're having a lot of different movements happening here in the community, because people are saying, I'm tired of being passive, or I'm tired of trying to do this way, because that way is not working. We have very inclusive communities here. However, there are still pockets of individuals that are being discriminated against that are not safe in this community. And we're going to take a stand to elevate that to the next level.
Demetrius, the last time you were here, we discussed Project Speak Up and the effort to identify hate crimes and assist victims of hate crimes. Is this sort of dovetailing with these two projects together?
Absolutely. I think that when you talk about hate crimes, you can't talk about hate crimes without talking about racism. It's kind of like, I don't even know. It's like talking about, I can't even give you a scenario. When you look at hate crimes, when you're talking about ethnicity, when you're talking about race, when you're talking about religion, when you're talking about immigrants, even when you're talking about sexual orientation, there's a common thread that race is playing a factor in that. Even when you're talking about LGBT community, when you turn on the TV, you see Black trans women being killed, you know, hand over fist in numbers. When you talk about immigrants, you're not talking about immigrants who have similarities to dominant culture. You're talking about immigrants who have different ethnicities and different cultural backgrounds that we're discriminating against and what that looks like. And so, absolutely, they do have a common thread.
So what are you hoping that people will do at the end of, say, Saturday, when this 24-hour stand against racism is completed? What are you hoping then happens for the next week, month, year, et cetera?
Yeah, we're asking everybody to sign a pledge to eliminate racism, and that's where you actively work to take a stand. So, I mean, just even some of the basics, the stop the bad jokes, the name calling, you know, those are things that we still hear all the time. And so if we can start by eliminating those, then we can really make a bigger change in our community, especially for our children.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Sherry Brockaway is Director of Training and Community Impact, and Demetrius Wolverton is Community Education Specialist for the YWCA of Kalamazoo. Links with more information about the Stand Against Racism can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Reinhold Niebuhr is credited with the Serenity Prayer, but a documentary shown on some PBS stations details his influence on theology, politics, and society at large. An American Conscience, the Reinhold Niebuhr Story, will be screened as part of Kalamazoo College's annual Thompson Lecture on Thursday, May 4th. It begins at 7 o'clock in the Dalton Theater in the Light Fine Arts Building. Jeremy Sabella was a visiting professor at Kay College last fall. He served as a consultant on the documentary and also wrote the companion book. Sabella and former Kalamazoo College professor Gary Dorian will lead a discussion on Reinhold Niebuhr after the showing of the documentary. Jeremy Sabella, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What got you interested in Reinhold Niebuhr just as an object of study, if we want to use that term?
Well, to be really broad about it, his rhetoric is really good. The first book I read by Niebuhr was actually in my doctoral program. I was already invested in another track. I thought I was going to do ancient Christianity. I picked up Niebuhr in my final semester of coursework for the first time. I read Moral Man and Immoral Society, and I was blown away. He's a really good writer, a really good rhetorician. He knows how to evoke emotions with words, and he's committed to talking about really basic problems in American life. In Moral Man and Immoral Society, he's talking about what do you need to do to actually affect large-scale social change? What does that require? What is it about human nature that makes us so resistant to those changes? And how do we bring about those changes given that people are stubborn and stuck in their ways and irrational in a lot of ways? And so it was both the strength of his rhetoric and the scope of his vision and his willingness to call a spade a spade. He's very, very blunt in the way that he talks about things, but I found that refreshing.
At one point, the commentator and author David Brooks, quite familiar to NPR listeners who regularly weighs in on the events of the day, but he mentions in this documentary that liberals can find things that they like in Reinhold Niebuhr, but there also are things that conservatives latch onto. Is it the case that Reinhold Niebuhr is just so prolific a writer and perhaps such a broad thinker that he wrote something that almost anybody can find and say, ah, that applies to me or that applies to the way I think?
Well, as David Brooks put it, everybody found something they liked in Niebuhr. And that's one of his great virtues, and it's also what makes him a little bit tricky. Niebuhr wrote voluminously. He published over 2,500 articles. I cannot tell you how many times I have checked that fact because it's mind-blowing to me. 2,500 articles. So he's writing constantly, and he's commenting on everything under the sun. And yes, he's doing so from a particular theological vantage point, but when your commentary is so broad on so many different issues, other people who are interested in that sort of theologically informed commentary are going to find something in that that they like and they can use. So on the one hand, I think he's unique as a bridge builder in our particular context. It's not just building bridges between religious discourse and political discourse, let's say. It's also building bridges between liberal and conservative. He's one of the only figures in our moment that liberals and conservatives still want to claim as one of their own. And that's a valuable thing. But I think we also need to confront the fact that we all have our own versions of Niebuhr. you know, Niebuhr can sort of be co-opted and weaponized for anyone's discourse. And that is something we have to be aware of in interacting with this thought.
And is that in part because as he goes through life, Reinhold Niebuhr at times goes back and revisits things which he has said and comes to different conclusions or maybe changes his view on things a bit and says that, you know, maybe what I thought previously doesn't really apply now, or maybe I need to take a fresh look at this particular issue?
So the magazine, The Christian Century, had a feature once upon a time called How My Mind Has Changed. Niebuhr wrote for that feature three times. The way that Gary Dorian put it, Reinhold Niebuhr changed his mind every 10 years. And there is something to that. He's very responsive to politics as they're developing. So a lot of his commentary is on current events. What Niebuhr sees as the major problems confronting American society in 1928 Detroit, let's say, where he did a lot of his, he was a pastor in Detroit for many years, is very different from what he sees as the major issues confronting America in 1939 with World War II on the horizon.
Barack Obama, a pretty progressive Democrat, Jimmy Carter could draw on Niebuhr. Some of the Reaganites like Niebuhr, some of the George W. Bush people like Niebuhr. Everyone picked something they liked.
You can tell a lot about a person's political leanings depending on which time period of Niebuhr they're interested in. For a lot of very good reasons, conservatives are attracted to Niebuhr talking to America at the pinnacle of world power, right? Talking about the pitfalls and the possibilities that come with wielding great power. Liberals and radicals tend to like the early Niebuhr, who's agitating for social change in the early 1930s. People of a more moderate streak tend to gravitate toward the Niebuhr of the World War II era, when he's trying to articulate a rationale for why we need democracy in a world where political options seem to be running out. So everybody can sort of pick and choose a little bit, and you can tell a lot about a person depending on which version of Niebuhr they gravitate toward.
How important is faith in the background of all of that? In other words, you know, if someone can reach different conclusions, does that mean that at the same time they are reexamining their faith? Or does it appear from his writings that he was reexamining his faith at times when maybe he reached some different conclusions about various issues?
Well, I think faith for Niebuhr is what gave him, in many ways, the confidence and courage to change his mind. In Niebuhr's understanding, he certainly believes in providence and believes that God is ultimately in control of history, but he's also very skeptical about the human ability to discern the workings of providence. And so he's holding those two things in tension. His assertion of providence gives him this theological framework out of which to analyze current events. His skepticism about the human ability to understand those workings are what caused him to pivot quite a bit and give him what I see as intellectual humility, right? The willingness to look at his early opinions and revise them over and over and over again because he doubts his own ability to understand the workings of providence. And so I think faith is crucial to Niebuhr's work. That doesn't mean that you have to agree with him on anything theologically to derive benefit from his analysis. There was actually a group in the 40s and 50s that called themselves Atheists for Niebuhr, right. That had no real interest in his theology, but they thought that the way he used the concept of something like original sin was really valuable. So you have these political commentators with no religious background talking about original sin.
And Gary Dorian says in the documentary that Niebuhr loved the idea that there was this group out there that called themselves Atheists for Niebuhr.
Oh, yeah. No, he was a committed pluralist in that regard. For him, Christianity was not about insider baseball. It was not a discourse for other Christians. It helped him. Christianity in his hands is something that helps you articulate certain truths about the way the world works, period.
One particular point in the documentary where I think perhaps Niebuhr's changing view of the world, along with his humility, maybe sort of intersect is the idea that he ended up debating his brother at one point about world affairs. And this is a very interesting story that his daughter told about how these two men, obviously both deep thinkers, obviously both committed in various ways to theology and to public discourse. But when they were debating, Niebuhr's daughter says, well, her father acknowledged that maybe Reinhold Niebuhr in this case was overmatched, right?
You know, so Helmut Richard Niebuhr, Reinhold's younger brother, was a dominant theologian in his own right. And in many ways, Elizabeth Sifton, Reinhold's daughter, says in the documentary, my father thought that he was the finer thinker and the clearer writer. True, I have the gift of gab, he would say, but Helmut is the better theologian. And there's a lot to back that up. So the debate that they had in 1930 was on the Japanese invasion of Manchuria and how the U.S. should respond. And Reinhold thought the U.S. should respond as assertively as they could with embargoes and things of that nature. And H. Richard thought that the U.S. should basically do nothing. In fact, his article was called The Grace of Doing Nothing. And he was advocating this position of, step back, stop pretending that you know how to control world affairs, because we don't, and we just need to let things play out. And so the brothers debated this position, and that continued to be a flashpoint between them throughout their careers. But their correspondence was always appreciative. And I think H. Richard is really responsible for Reinhold Niebuhr becoming a really good theologian. It was after Moral Man and Immoral Society where H. Richard basically said to Reinhold in their private correspondence, listen, you're a great social critic. You're one of the best. There's no doubt about that. But you need to shore up your theological foundations. Right? You need to revisit your Pauline scriptures in the Bible. You need to revisit your Augustine. You need to really delve into this concept of original sin and explore what that means for your particular brand of social criticism. And Reinhold took those critiques to heart and in the process became a really good theologian in his own right. And that has everything to do, in my view, with H. Richard.
At times in the documentary, when you hear him talking, back in the 30s and 40s, it was time in Detroit, for instance, he sounds like a man ahead of his time on the issue of race. But we come to a point later in this documentary where Martin Luther King Jr. says, why don't you join me? And he declines. So how do you balance all that out on the issue of race and where Reinhold Niebuhr ended up?
Yeah, the question of race and Niebuhr is a complicated one. And I think it comes down to the fact that Niebuhr was at his best when he was involved with issues firsthand. He's great on race after he's been in Detroit for 13 years during the Ford boom years. He chairs an interracial committee during that time. He interacts directly with leaders of the Black community. He takes on the Ku Klux Klan. And in the process, because he had that personal contact, develops this really nuanced sense of what was going on and how to respond to it. And so the conclusions that he draws in the early 1930s were well ahead of their time. He is very full-throated in his advocacy for the Black community and their struggle for justice. By the early 1950s, he has a stroke in 1952. That sidelines him. He has to cut back a lot in his physical activity. He can't see the civil rights movement unfolding firsthand. He's not going to their meetings. He's not in church basements. And I think, from his Riverside apartment, he's not able to appreciate how much the civil rights movement means. He's concerned at that point with stability. He just got out of the World War II era, this incredibly unstable era. And he's looking at the unfolding civil rights movement and is concerned that this is pushing too hard, too fast. And I think he's rightly criticized for taking that position, because there isn't very much of anything ethical in terms of those considerations. Stability on its own, yes, it's a good thing, but we also have other ethical considerations that we need to think about. And so So Reinhold goes for stability at that point, ends up articulating this conservative position on race, declines to sign this document pushing Eisenhower to take action in the mid-1950s. But then he, interestingly enough, hits his stride again in the mid-1960s. So at this point, he's even older. His health is in even worse shape, but he's developed these relationships with people like Heschel, who was very involved in the movement. He ended up doing an interview with James Baldwin. And so the contact with figures like Heschel and Baldwin, I think, reinvigorated his thinking on race once again, because he was able to have this personal contact with figures who are directly involved.
I mentioned at the beginning that one of the things Reinhold Niebuhr is known for, and perhaps if you're looking for the single sentence of what he is, the man credited with the Serenity Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that too short shrift of what he did? I mean, is that just too simplistic that, that this is the thing we recognize him for? Because if we're going to pick something out of all his other writings, it's hard to say that this is the piece that stands out. Is that why maybe the Serenity Prayer gets mentioned first?
What I see the Serenity Prayer as is an indication of how much Niebuhr's influence has seeped into American culture without us even knowing it. The Serenity Prayer is one of the few prayers that even non-religious people know and are familiar with. And, this is striking to me just a few weeks ago, kind of in a similar vein of how deeply Niebuhr's permeated. We find this story about James Comey, the FBI director, having a secret Twitter account under the alias of Reinhold Niebuhr, right?
God give us grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed. Courage to change the things that should be changed. And the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other.
So yeah, it is a rather simplistic way of getting at Niebuhr, but I also think you can make the case that his work as a whole is really just unfolding the content of that prayer, right? He's looking, how do you balance serenity and courage when confronting catastrophe on a global level? When do you run up against limits of things you can't change? When do you need the courage to change things that need to be changed, even though it's really hard?
And does it also reflect, as we've talked about, those changes in opinion, which he wrote about, his own struggle with that very thing? What can I change? What can I not change? How much energy to put into the things that I think should be changed?
Yeah, Niebuhr wrestled with that his whole life. And that wrestling is obvious in his writings. And this is something that I appreciate about him as an academic. It's easy to try to mask the personal reasons why we write about what we write, why we're interested in the topics that we're interested in, why we come to the conclusions that we come to. And for Niebuhr, it's all out there all the time. He's telling you quite clearly, these are the things that keep me up at night. These are the things that give me anxiety. And here are the resources that help me cope with that and help me figure out how to wake up in the morning and keep going. And for Niebuhr, it came down to faith, right? His faith sustained him. His faith helped him to confront the worst on a daily basis, to just stare at the worst in human nature and still hold on to hope in the midst of that. As somebody who studies his thought, I find that very reassuring in my own work, right? That we can be engaged at this deep emotional and spiritual level with what we do, even if what we're doing is mostly intellectual.
Jeremy Sabella, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Jeremy Sabella served as a consultant on the documentary An American Conscience, The Reinhold Niebuhr Story, that will be screened as part of Kalamazoo College's annual Thompson Lecture on Thursday, May 4th. It begins at 7 o'clock in the Dalton Theater in the Light Fine Arts Building. Sabella is also the author of the companion book with that documentary. You can find links with more information at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.